This is Jim Engster. Coming today on the show, a busy list of guests, including Dean Koontz, 14 number one bestsellers from the New York Times list. His latest is Deeply Odd, an Odd Thomas novel from the master storyteller Dean Koontz. Also on the show, we are slated to hear from the chair of the Louisiana Democratic Party, Karen Carter Peterson. She stirred up some passions this week with her remarks about Medicaid expansion and race in Louisiana. And Jim Donilon, the former state lawmaker, now the insurance commissioner, is here for the start of hurricane season to give his thoughts on where we're going June 1st and beyond in Louisiana with a busy season expected. And Charles Alexander, College Football Hall of Famer. He holds the record for most yards in a season for an LSU running back. He's with us as well. But now the news on WRKF. This is Jim Engster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633, your local number. Outside our area, please call 877-217-5757. Engstershow at WRKF.org works as well. Dean Koontz is our leadoff guest, the author who is best known for his novels, which can broadly be described as suspense thrillers, but he also frequently incorporates elements of horror, science fiction, mystery, and satire. He's had 14 and number one bestsellers on the hardcover list of the New York Times. Now he's back with Deeply Odd, an Odd Thomas novel, which is destined to be number one again. Good morning, Dean Koontz.
Good morning.
Well, tell us about Odd Thomas. Certainly an odd first name.
Well, he's a young fry cook, and when we met him in the first book, which was called Odd Thomas, he was working at a grill in a little town of Pico Mundo in the California desert, and his life seemed very simple on the surface, but it was very complex underneath because Odd has certain paranormal abilities, and one of them is the ability to see the lingering spirits of the dead, and this kind of shapes his life. And now we're to the what is essentially the sixth of seven full-length novels in the series, and I did one shorter novel, Deeply Odd, which has followed him as he moves around trying to find meaning in his life after the events of the first book. But they're all standalone, so you can enter the series anywhere. And in this one, Odd just goes into this little California coastal town to buy socks, but it's not going to be an ordinary day because he meets a man who is about to commit really horrendous murders, and he sees this in a psychic flash, and he doesn't know who's going to be murdered or when or where, and it becomes sort of a chase novel that ends up with the chaser becoming the chasee. And will Odd succeed or will he not? I think he will probably succeed.
The New York Times says the nice young fry cook with the occult powers is Koontz's most likable creation, candid, upright, amusing, and sometimes withering. How do you keep it going? You, as I said, you've had 14 number one bestsellers, Dean, and the imagination is still vivid after all these years.
I probably have to live to about 140 to write all the ideas that are in my head at the moment. And thank God it just keeps coming. I think it's the imagination's like a muscle. The more you use it, the better it gets. And I used to, in my youth, worried I'd run out of ideas, but I long ago stopped worrying about that.
Do you ever go places you didn't even expect to once you start writing?
Oh, always, because I never do outlines. I just give the character the open up in a thought situation and then let the character figure out how to get out of it. And if the book's really working, the character always takes it places you wouldn't go, which is great because I kind of have a low boredom threshold. So if I knew what was coming next, I wouldn't be able to sit here and write it.
When did this Odd Thomas character come into your mind?
I was writing a book called The Face, and I just suddenly thought, my name is Odd Thomas, I lead an unusual life, and it had nothing to do with The Face. It just was almost like it was beamed into my head. And I turned to a yellow legal pad I keep beside me to make notes and started to write out that couple of lines so I wouldn't forget them. And the next thing I knew, I'd written out the whole first chapter of the first novel by longhand, which I'd never done before or since. And I recognized it was going to work, or it seemed that it would. I always have a lot of self-doubt, but I kind of felt this might be something special. So here we are now in the sixth book with one more to go.
Dean, how much of your work is rooted in a very tough upbringing. You had some challenges as a young man.
Well, we were very poor because my father held about 44 jobs in 34 years, and he was alcoholic with tendencies to violence, and a womanizer and a gambler, and so you never knew if you would have a roof over your head the next day. But even as a kid, I always felt that happiness was a choice, and if you look around you in this life, there's always something pretty wonderful around every next corner. And for me, when I was very young, that wonderfulness was often books, and they helped me to escape that household. And my mother was a great person, but there was too much darkness there. But books brought light into it, and I think that's why I probably eventually wanted to become a writer.
Your mother must have been a saint.
She was an awfully good person. She had a very difficult life because of my father, and but she struggled through, and she wasn't a complainer. And I remember when I graduated college, or was about to, I came home on the weekend, and out of nowhere, my mother, as I was leaving for college, said to me, "What would you think if I divorced your father?" And I thought, I actually said to her, "I can't understand why you didn't do that 20 years ago." And it was an age where people didn't divorce easily. And she just looked at me and turned away and said, "I don't want to talk about it anymore." But she endured, I think, because she felt it would be worse for me not to have a father. But sometimes I think she was wrong about that, that sometimes it might be better to get that violent person out of your life.
You have written that you were influenced dramatically as a very young man by your experience with the Appalachian Poverty Program. How did this affect
you? That was my first full-time job. I'd worked jobs in high school, stock boy in a supermarket and that kind of thing. But this was my first teaching position, and I was supposed to be teaching people in this little coal mining town, students who were bright, but because of their poverty, they had everything going against them. And the idea was that a one-on-one kind of tutoring with very small classes would help them and bring them out. But unfortunately, it doesn't always work the way it's intended. And the teachers in the system largely decided that this was an opportunity to get all of their discipline problems out of their class. And they dumped the discipline problems into my classes. And so a lot of the kids I taught had already been in reform school for some period of time or had police records, and it was a very unusual first year. But it was a year I got through, and there were some of those kids were indelibly imprinted in my mind, because while many of them were great discipline problems, there were a few of them that, if their lives had been a little different, might have had a much better chance when they grew up. But some of them didn't even make it very long out of high school. So it taught me that maybe I didn't want to have that job for the rest of my life. So after a year, I bailed for a regular teaching job in another school.
The book is Deeply Odd from Dean Koontz. He is destined to be his 15th number one New York Times best-selling book. How is the process of writing for you? Does it come easy?
Some days it does, and some days it doesn't. When you get into what psychologists call a flow state and it's working, the worst thing you can do is think, wow, it's going really well here today, because then it'll immediately stop. But I generally take about 5 or 6 months to write a novel, but I work at least 60 hours a week, and toward the end of the book, 70 and more. So it's hard work, but it's play at the same time, because I love what I do.
Well, thank you for joining us today, Dean Koontz. The latest is Deeply Odd, an Odd Thomas novel. Thank you, Dean.
Thank you. Thanks for having me there.
My pleasure. And now we're joined by Jim Donnellan, the insurance commissioner, who is a man who's been around the block for many years in Louisiana politics, about two decades in the Louisiana legislature, and he is now the man who follows storms in Louisiana like few, if any, others. And June 1st, meaning tomorrow, is the start of hurricane season. Busy time for you. And we're glad you're embarking once again on your storm tour with a stop in our studio, Jim Donnellan.
Glad to be with you again, Jim. And it is that time of the year, as you said. And in Louisiana, that means we need to be prepared.
What does this season offer? It looks like it's going to be a busy one.
It is predicted to be so. A month ago by Colorado State University, Dr. Gray was the guru, if you will, of hurricane predictions. He's in semi-retirement, but still, I guess you'd call it the chair of that department at Colorado State. And his staff predicted a month ago that we'd have an above-average season, 18 named storms, 9 of which would become hurricanes, and 4 would become intense hurricanes, Category 3 or higher, which means 111 or greater mile-per-hour wind speeds. And most recently, this week, the National Weather Service came out with their predictions, which were a little more, a little higher, a little scarier, if you will, than the Colorado State predictions, but pretty similar. Mm-hmm. Above average, a handful of very severe hurricanes, again, reminding us that it's that time of year and we need to get prepared.
Well, for those who don't have insurance, you're not going to be able to get it if a storm is on your front doorstep. But can somebody go out today
and
get insurance?
And you bring up a good point. For property insurance, private sector insurance, typically the companies stop writing when a hurricane enters the Gulf. And it's available until they stop writing. So certainly today. For the National Flood Insurance Program, they have a provision in their law. It's administered by FEMA, and the congressional act that governs the National Flood Insurance Program limits policies to coverage within 30 days. It prevents coverage from starting until after 30 days has passed from the time that the policy has been acquired, purchased.
Well, as far as what people should keep handy, if a storm approaches, and it looks like we may have a few that do approach us, what documents should we keep?
Well, and that's a great question. And the first thing I would advise your listeners to do is get out their cell phone and document their contents in their home. Just walk through the home and take photographs of the bedroom set, the living room, the flat screen TV, all of the assets that are subject to being damaged or destroyed in a hurricane, wind, or flood event. Next thing, access your policy and take a look at it. Don't be caught unaware by something like a named storm or hurricane deductible. That can be a big expense for homeowners. Typically, policies, homeowners' policies, come with something between 2 and 5% named storm deductibles. They were the exception 10 years ago. They're the rule today. When I had my Katrina loss for my damage to my home in Metairie, it had a 2% named storm deductible. Mm-hmm. And as important as it is to know that you have that deductible, also know that it's not 2% of your claim. It's 2% of your insured value, so that if your home is insured for $150,000, your named storm deductible is $3,000. That's surprising to a lot of folks the first time they encounter it, as many here in the Baton Rouge area did with Hurricane Gustav in 2008, and last year in the New Orleans area for the first time since Katrina with Hurricane Isaac.
What's a single-season hurricane deductible?
Well, what happened after Gustav, similar to what happened in 2005 when southeast Louisiana got crushed by Hurricane Katrina August 29th, 2005. And lo and behold, 3 weeks later, in the same track headed to the same landfall destination, along comes Hurricane Rita. Fortuitously, it made a left turn at the fortuitously for southeast Louisiana and skimmed along the coast and made its actual landfall in the sparsely populated area of Cameron Parish. Big difference being 1,600 lost lives in the Katrina event, and by 3 weeks later, it was less populated and better prepared, and no one lost their life.
We'll return a few more minutes with Insurance Commissioner Jim Donilon. If you'd like to join the conversation, 297-5633, and we'll also hear from Alexander the Great, Charles Alexander, after this 90-second pause. This is Jim Engster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. A few more minutes with Jim Donilon, the insurance commissioner, 297-5633, your number. Engstershow at WRKF.org works online. And then we'll hear from Charles Alexander, the LSU College Football Hall of Famer and the most prolific runner in LSU history in the year of 1977. HB in Denham Springs. HB, you're on with Jim Donilon. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Mr. Donilon, I took your advice several years ago and chopped around, and I got a real good independent agent to write my homeowners and car insurance policy. Even in spite of that, though, each one of them, every year seems like they're going up on insurance, and sooner or later, like the elderly or the people on fixed incomes, I think the median income is $40,000 for a family of four in Louisiana. When does the point stop where they can insurance is no longer affordable, but yet they're going to have it if they have a mortgage either on their car and or house? Thank you, sir.
Yes, sir, and great question, and a very challenging question, certainly. As with everything else, the cost of gasoline and the cost of utilities, the cost of groceries goes up. In recent years, those other products on a national basis have gone up less rapidly than they had in the past. But the Consumer Price Index still generates about a 2% per year increase in the cost of living generally. In homeowners insurance, our cost of coverage for a typical home in Louisiana has gone up 4.5% per year for the past 5 years. But if you take the big carriers out of it, State Farm, Allstate, out of that mix, it's only 2.5% for the other companies doing business in our state. Again, making the point that the caller led off with, the value of shopping around. Now, how to stop it? The only way I can see that policymakers could stop the increases and protect those on low incomes, fixed incomes, would be through something like a voucher program that would be made available on a means-tested basis.
Any parting thoughts as we're on the eve of the hurricane season?
Yes, Jim, and I appreciate this opportunity to visit with your listeners again. And you asked earlier what should they do to be prepared, and I started with take pictures of your assets through your home with your cell phone. Just keep it available in the event of a loss. Number two, look at your coverages. Know what your deductibles are. Prepared to meet those deductibles. Bring with you when you evacuate your insurance policies, your contact information mm-hmm. for your agent, and protect yourself and your family and your property as we go into this challenging time of the year here in Louisiana, the third most often visited by hurricanes over the past 100 years of the 50 states.
And you're a big proponent of flood insurance.
I am indeed. It is still the best property insurance value that a property owner can make, although in the recent reform and reauthorization of that program, it was put on a 5-year glide path to actuarially sound rates. And that represents, for a existing policyholder, a 20% per year increase in cost to reach that actuarial price that FEMA has determined for each policyholder. But we are the most benefited by that program of any of the 50 states, and as such, all of our property owners, whether they're in Shreveport or Grand Isle, should take advantage of that federally subsidized National Flood Insurance Program.
And as we segue to Charles Alexander, there are no bigger LSU football fans than Jim Donilon, who travels with the Tigers. But today is the 70th birthday of Joe Willie Namath.
Is that right?
That's right.
Incredible. And I will leave you with this bit of trivia. My high school classmate, our mutual friend, the former mayor of Baton Rouge, Pat Screen, was the most valuable player on the Sporting News High School All-American team his senior year at my high school, Jesuit High School in New Orleans. And the second team quarterback on that team was from Beaver Falls, Pennsylvania, Joe Willie Namath.
Joe Willie Namath and Pat Screen, who has been gone now for almost 19 years. He's 18 days older than Joe Namath. His 70th birthday would have been May 13th. And as you note, back in the day when New Orleans didn't have professional football, I was a kid in New Orleans then. He was
the Billy Cannon of New Orleans.
Yeah, he really was. And of course, he had a fine career at LSU.
But none of them exceeded the man to
my
left.
That's right. I think, and I say this with confidence, the greatest running back in the history of LSU football is in our studio.
Second that motion.
And he's had some others, including the great Billy Cannon, who preceded him, and some fine ones who have been after Charles Alexander. But in 1977, he ruled the world, at least the college football world. And Charles is from a hurricane haven of sorts, Galveston, Texas. I bet you've been through a few hurricanes, haven't you, Charles?
Oh, yes. I think my first one I experienced, I was about 5 or 6 years old. I don't know if you remember, Hurricane Carla in Galveston, Texas. And basically, we had to walk across the street to a shelter, and the hurricane ended up destroying our home. So I've had some experiences.
Wow. And of course, Galveston was destroyed. The whole city was knocked out in 1900. I think 6,000 people died.
Wow.
That was a little before your time, our time, but but I'm sure there are vestiges of that to this day.
Yeah, it's always best to, once you get the warnings, is to leave.
So how does a kid from Galveston, Texas, end up signing with LSU in 1975?
I was recruited real heavily by Jerry Stovall. Jerry Stovall sold himself to me first, and then the school, going on that campus, visiting Tiger Stadium, it's nothing like it. And I just wanted an opportunity to play in front of, at the time, the stadium held about 70,000 people. And once you go see that as a kid, it's just something you want to play in front of those fans.
Mm-hmm.
Now I think that stadium holds about 92, 93, and yep, there's an addition that's going on. I think it's
will be completed.
It'll be close to 100. So it's exciting times at LSU.
297-5633 for Charles Alexander. In 1977, he rushed for 1,686 yards in 11 games. And in those days, bowl games did not count in statistics. So if you add the bowl game, it's 1,883, by far the most yards in the history of LSU for one season. And it started in 1975. Your first game, if I remember right, was in Lincoln, Nebraska. That must have been quite an experience.
A game I will never remember. I don't know if I got back to the line of scrimmage that particular game. I think I had 8 rushes for -8 yards. It was like welcome to college football. And it kind of made me think if I belong, you know. So I just kept working and worked harder and harder, and things got a little bit better for me that freshman year.
And then, of course, your sophomore year, you broke out and you were playing with Terry Robiskie, who had a big year, as did you. And collectively, the two of you got almost 2,000 yards that year out of the tailback position. So you had quite a start at LSU. And then, boom, 1977, you have the year like no one's had before or since. What do you remember about that season and the people you played with?
The 77 season, I remember using a lot of ice on Sundays because I think I averaged 28 carries a game.
And you had some games, two of them over 40.
Yeah, 40, I had several 40, games 40, over 40.
40
yeah,
carries.
Exactly. And
they wouldn't do that today.
No, I think they kind of rotate backs a little bit more. But back in those days, I mean, we relied heavily on our rushing game. And it was sweep right, sweep left, draw right, mm-hmm, draw left.
Mm-hmm.
And it was tough, but we were pretty successful. We went 8-3 and had an opportunity to go to the Sun Bowl.
And played Stanford and Bill Walsh. Unfortunately, lost that game, but Charles had quite a game, 31 carries, 197 yards. I remember in the Oregon game, in which you set a single-game record for rushes and yards, Charlie McClendon called a timeout to allow you to score a fourth touchdown, which was a record. And the Oregon coach at that time was Rich Brooks. He didn't like that very well, did he?
Not at all. I remember that. I think I had come out the game probably at beginning of the third quarter because we were
way ahead.
Way ahead. And the sports information at the time was Paul Manasseh, and he let Coach McClendon know that if I got another touchdown, I had an opportunity to break another record at LSU, and Coach Mack put me back in the game, and Coach Brooks didn't like that.
Yeah, I remember him saying, I wish he had broken his leg.
Yeah, you got a good memory.
Yeah. Well, you stayed remarkably fit. I was just looking at some photos of Hoki Gajon, who really is beaten up badly. He was your colleague at LSU and played in the NFL, as did you. But you look like, and I'm not exaggerating here. Sometimes I do when I have ex-players in here, but Charlie looks like he could still play.
Defensive tackle. I'm tight
a little more, Charlie, but you're in shape.
Yeah. Well, I try to. The older we get, we need to watch what we eat a little bit more. So I try to walk. And with my knees as bad as they are, I just have to try to keep track of it and make sure I take care of myself.
And Charles was a big back then. He would be a big back now. He's well over 6 feet tall, played at about 220, 230 in the NFL, and sprinter speed. I remember Jerry Stovall once telling me that the number four that you wore at LSU, the famous number four, was because you tell the story.
Okay. I remember I was a freshman, and I wore number 20 in high school, and it's ironic what we'll be doing tomorrow with Billy. But I went to the equipment manager, and I looked at the program, and I said, well, nobody's wearing number 20, so I'm going to request number 20. So I requested number 20 to the equipment manager, and everybody just broke out laughing at me and like, man, this guy doesn't know his LSU football history. So they said, you can't wear number 20. That jersey's retired. It belongs to Billy Cannon and Heisman Trophy winner. And I said, oh, man. So I thought and thought, and I said, well, how about number four? And they gave me number four.
Number four, and nobody wore it quite like Charles Alexander. In those days, you had those tearaway jerseys, didn't you?
Yeah, that was fun. Sometimes it was some of the teams would just tear it off to get you out of the game. But that was we went through some games. I probably went through 7 or 8 of those things, and I think later on they outlawed it, and basically you had to wear a game jersey.
Well, Charles and number 20, Billy Cannon, LSU's only Heisman winner, were on the cover of the first issue of Tiger Rag, September 1st, 1978. At that time, Billy was 40 and Charles was 20. Tomorrow they'll be recreating that event with Billy at 75 and Charles at 55. 55. Yeah. Have you two stayed in touch?
Yeah, we talk every now and then. Billy's a great guy. He was a tremendous help to me when I was at LSU, and always admired him.
Well, you came to LSU from Galveston, Texas as a sprinter, and we're talking about a guy who once, what, about 4.3? Was that your best time in the 40?
Yes, 4.3 in the 40, and I was a state champion in the state of Texas in the 100 and the 200. Back in those days, there was the 100-yard dash and the 220-yard dash. Now it's the meters. So.
And a big man. But Coach Mack didn't like his players in other sports, did he?
You remember that too. I did. I ran in one track meet at LSU. I had one day to practice and ran in the meet the next day. I ran the 60-yard dash, and I think I came in third, but that was pretty good for only having one day of practice. And I got called into Coach Mack's office, and he said, he used to all call us good buddy. He said, good buddy, how'd you like running a track meet? I said, Coach, I really enjoyed myself. I loved it. He said, I hope you took a picture because that's your last one. So that was the end of my track career at LSU. But he said, you need to be out of spring ball. So that was the end of that.
Well, he had this aversion for players participating in other sports when he lost Mike Miley to baseball, and he certainly didn't want Charlie Alexander to become a trackster. But you could have been as successful on the track as you were in football if you'd concentrated on that.
Maybe so, but, you know, now that I look back at it, even though I did enjoy track, I was really rough around the edges when I was a freshman. And I did need to be in spring ball and get repetitions and learn how to run the football. It was just not catching the football and running as fast as you could. You know, you had to develop some moves or look at the cutback lanes and things like that and have a little patience. And I did develop a little bit better playing spring ball.
Some backs don't like contact. You seem to relish it. When a guy was in front of you, you didn't try to dance around him. You tried to run over him. and most of the time you did. You really liked getting hit and hitting other people, didn't you?
Yeah, that was just my style. Maybe I liked the contact or whatever, but that was my style to not only take the lick, but punish the tackler for tackling me.
Well, I recall interviewing you after Super Bowl 16 when you came back to Baton Rouge after the Bengals lost a close one to the 49ers in Joe Montana's first Super Bowl victory. I think 26-21 was the final. And Forrest Gregg, who was your coach, you wouldn't speak ill of him then and may not now, but he had the bright idea of making you a blocking back.
Yes, he did. Pete Johnson was our fullback, and I was a halfback, and the offense was centered around the fullback, and I was about 230, 235, and Pete, on a good day, was every bit of 275, about 5'10", and that was just his offense, and we were successful. We ended up going to the Super Bowl, but I just wanted to carry the ball a little bit more than I did, but we did what we did, and we were successful at it a couple of years.
But you never got the opportunity to carry the ball 20, 30, 35 times a game, which you could have done.
Oh, I wish I could have, but that's just the way things worked out. I didn't like him, but I did what I had to do to stay on the team, you know.
And you lasted for a while. And when Charles retired, he did have one NFL record. And it's such an unpublicized record that I'm not even sure he knows he has it. And it's one that is now being rivaled by a guy in New England, Ben Jarvis Green. But it was the fewest fumbles per carry. You only fumbled 6 times in your career. And per carry, that was the fewest in NFL history. Did you know that?
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Well, now they compute stats on everything. Yeah, okay, but you're number one.
Okay. Well, I'm going to have to put that in my book.
Just like
Chris, I got one claim to fame.
Chris Jackson at Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf. He holds the NBA record for free throw percentage, and that's another thing that is not for a career not publicized a great deal. You liked other sports, didn't you? You got into basketball, and I even saw you once at a baseball game at LSU.
Watching basketball, watching baseball. I couldn't play either one. The Astros, I was brought up in Galveston, loved to watch the Astros.
Rusty Staub, you remember him?
Yeah, I remember
Rusty Staub. He was a high school team.
Oh, really?
Jim Donnelly.
Yeah, but I, big time Astro fan, love the New York Knicks. I used to watch them when I was a kid. And I try to.
I didn't know that about the Knicks. I loved the Knicks too.
Yeah,
1970,
yeah.
May
go back
the 8th.
To Walt Frazier and that group and Willis.
You remember
Reed.
The five starters? May 8th, 1970. They beat the Lakers in the 7th game at Madison Square Garden.
I 113 think I can call 99. At least four of them.
Who were the starters?
Dave DeBuscher.
Right.
Willis Reed,
right.
Walt Frazier.
Right.
Was it Dick Barnett?
Dick Barnett. And then the other forward.
I can't was get it, the other one.
Did you say Bill Bradley?
No, Bradley. I don't think I did.
Bill Bradley was the other. He was the other one. That was 1970. Okay. And then they won again in 1973.
Okay. Right, yeah. And I had an opportunity to go to Madison Square Garden for the induction.
We'll hold that thought and be back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Charles Alexander with us for a few more moments, and then we are slated to hear from the senator from New Orleans, Karen Carter-Peterson, who's chair of the Louisiana Democratic Party. Did want to note that Larry Jones, a former athletic director at LSU, twice the interim AD and one of the biggest fundraisers in the history of the school in his tenure at the LSU Alumni Association, he lost his battle with cancer yesterday. Age 79, he was LSU's Alumnus of the Year for this year, and he was on this show just a few months ago. But we will miss Larry Jones. Charles Alexander was inducted in the College Football Hall of Fame last year in New York City at Madison Square Garden. You took a lot of your teammates with you, didn't you?
Well, a lot of them were there, and that was a great, great honor to see those faces. We had a great time.
I'm told, you didn't tell me this, but I'm told that you took your offensive line, the Root Hogs, if you didn't.
Well, they took themselves, but they were there. They were well represented. We might have had a total, not only starters, but backups, guys that played on the second team also, anywhere from, I think it might have been 9 or 10 guys there. So that was really nice to have those. Even Kelly Simmons, my fullback, he was there. So it was great. All we needed was Carlos Carson and Cliff Lane on the tight end there, and we would have run one more play. You know, a
couple of questions that I'll forward to you, and we'll do it briefly. Jim wants to know, what did Jerry Stovall say to you to get you to come to LSU?
Coach Stovall made me one promise, and he looked me in the eye, and he said, sometimes when people look you in the eye, you're like, yeah, right, he's just saying this. But he looked me in the eye, and he said, I'm going to make you the best you can be. And he said, I will commit to that. And if you work hard and do what I say, you might be able to go to the next level if you stay healthy. And he made that commitment to me, and he said, I'll make sure that I'll stay on you to get your degree, and I'll be like another father to you. So that's why I just believe what he said.
And Ryan wants to know why you so rarely fumbled the ball.
I don't know. I just felt like, you know, carrying a football was if someone put it in your hand, you had to do all you could to hold on to it. Mm-hmm. Because if you didn't, they'd put somebody else in there that could. So it was an important thing to me, not only to get the yards, mm-hmm. but to hold on to the football.
I'm looking at your hands. I think that might have had something to do with it.
Well, they all banged up now, but yeah, I just tried to strengthen my arms and my hands as much as I could, and just hold on to it like it was a piece of gold.
And finally, you're now a business person back home in Texas, your other home, and you're in the food business.
Yes, my full-time job, I'm in the oil and gas industry, but I picked up a business called Come On Man Cajun Seasoning. I developed it myself. It's blended out of Opelousas, Louisiana, and it's in several stores here in Baton Rouge, and you can also order it on the Internet.
Come On Man
Cajun Seasoning.
From Charles Fred Alexander, the pride of Galveston, Texas. Thank you, Charles.
Thank you.
Good to see
Appreciate
you.
It.
We're joined now by Karen Carter Peterson, who's joining us from the Senate floor, I believe, or close to it. They're obviously doing business for the state in the final week of the legislative session. And good morning to you, Senator.
Good morning, Jim, and thanks for having me on the show.
Well, nice to talk with you, but it's been a busy week for you.
It has, and I'm right in the chamber in the ante room. Going to step away just a second. I wanted to certainly accept your invitation to come on and chat for a bit, okay. But I do have to get back to the floor.
I understand. Well, Kevin, let's play the cut, the one that people are talking about in various ways with Karen Carter Peterson.
I have talked to so many members, both in the House and the Senate, and you know what? You ready? You ready what it comes down to? It's not about how many federal dollars we can receive. It's not about that. You ready? It's about race. No, nobody wants to talk about that.
All right. Senator Peterson, what did you mean?
Yeah, well, I meant exactly what I said. I had several conversations with members as I advocated for Senate Bill 125, and then earlier this week I tried to amend the bill for Medicaid expansion here in Louisiana, which, of course, you know, a lot of folks know the facts. It would tend to about 400,000 people who are currently uninsured and except, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars on behalf of the state, and the governor is opposed to that. I had many conversations with House members and Senate members, and the issue of race was brought up. It wasn't the only issue brought up, but yes, it was an issue, and sometimes it's hard for people to hear or talk about race, but it's a fact in the conversations that I had. And I think that, you know, I'm not going to shy away from what I said because what I said was true. I didn't call anyone a racist. I didn't name any of my colleagues or divulge any confidences in kind of, you know, conversations. The discussion was about, you know, the politics of voting for Obamacare and the fact that he was a black president. And in Louisiana, in fact, that is a difficult decision for some people who were elected. Are there members who told me for other reasons that they voted against it? Absolutely, right? But I was just sharing a fact. And, Jim, as you know, I mean, I know you've watched me in the last 14 years. I've never been one to shy away from the facts and to just tell the truth, and that's what happened. I really think I saw that the governor took the time to do an exclusive interview with respect to this issue, one of the few, I believe, of this session, and called for me to apologize. And so let me just jump at that really quickly if there's an apology due anyone. I think the governor owes an apology to all of the people in this state to turn away 100% of federal funds, and those federal funds are our tax dollars gone to Washington, that can come back and inure to the benefit of Louisiana citizens who are working-class families that can't afford insurance, that need to be covered. And at the end of the day, if those folks aren't covered, those folks like me, who have insurance and can afford insurance, ultimately end up paying for it through our premiums or increase hospitalization costs. So I wanted to just, you know, take the opportunity certainly to come on and share with you. I don't know if you have any additional questions.
Well, yeah, but why do you think a bill that would have given the governor kind of a way out, modeling our plan after the Arkansas plan, if lawmakers had seen the wisdom of it, only got 37 votes in the House? Was that about race? What was the reason?
Yeah, I'm telling you about some of the conversations that I had with members, and they were brutally honest with me about the dilemma that they felt they had. And I think that bills should be judged and evaluated based on the four corners of the document and the legislation, okay? The fact is, it's not always the case, and in this case, it was a factor among others. Everybody didn't make that decision based on race, but the fact is that some, in fact, shared with me that that was a problem for them. I think that whether it was the House or the Senate, their members who made their decision on different factors, and everybody has to answer to their constituents as to why they made that decision. But at the end of the day, no one can argue that it's good fiscal policy to accept 100% of dollars that would cover when we don't have the money right now, and we are going to be debating on the Senate floor tomorrow the budget where there's a huge shortfall in higher ed, K-12, and health care. We're going to turn down 100% of federal funds that could cover a needy population, such as those that are working-class families that are uninsured. That's not fair. I think that it's egregious to do that. This is not unusual, though. I think the governor has continued to put his national ambition above the interest of the citizens. He's done that repeatedly when it came to broadband in rural communities, when it came to high-speed rail, when it came to unemployment insurance, and when it came to early childhood education and federal dollars going to all those initiatives, he's turned it down. And it would have inured to the benefit of the citizens of this state. And I think that's egregious.
Why do you think, Senator, there hasn't been more public outcry? The governor has shown an ability at times to change his mind, as he did on the tax swap. But
you know, that's a good question. I think that, well, let me just say, I'm proud to have worked with the Louisiana Association of Catholic Bishops, the Louisiana Primary Care Association, the Louisiana Hospital Association, the Association of Retired People, and, excuse me, so many others that have been pushing this initiative because they know what's at stake. I'm not sure if you're aware, but in a recent poll, and I'd be happy to provide it to you, I can have my staff send it to you, 62% of Louisianians have supported Medicaid expansion. That includes Democrats and Republicans, independents, conservatives, men, women, black, white, Asian, Hispanics. 62% of the people in this state realize that it's time to put people above politics and to do what's right by the citizens. Governor Jan Brewer, Governor Chris Christie, two Republican governors that don't always agree with President Obama, have decided that it's the law of the land, it's going to help the people in my state, and it's something that I should embrace and implement because it will help people. And in fact, it's a matter of life and death for a lot of people. You know, I don't know if you have health insurance. I'm blessed to have it. But it's not something that I have to think about every day, because if I'm not feeling well or I need medical attention, I can call a doctor. There are many people who sit at home and are literally in pain, literally cannot afford their medication, and it affects their life. And it's unfortunate that we live in such an industrialized country and a society where this is not prioritized. But I am proud that there are so many governors, Democrats and Republicans, that have accepted it and have put politics aside. I would just hope that our governor could do the same. I think there's hope. I think there's no deadline on this. So, you know, the way that we, Ben Nevers amended the legislation. Senator Nevers is from Washington Parish, Bogalusa area. He amended the legislation, and we've got what we've called the Louisiana plan that models a lot Arkansas's model. And that plan will permit us to use the Medicaid dollars for private health insurance, we thought that might, you know, move the ball a little bit, right? And I just don't want folks to sit back and think that this fight is over. It's not going away. We need to heighten awareness to what the benefits are to businesses, for example, that won't have to pay these penalties come January 2014 when we don't implement it. They're going to be imposed penalties. That's the law as it stands right now. And so there are many benefits, and even after this session, if it's not done this session, we're going to keep pushing ahead to get it done because there's no deadline, and hopefully if we don't do it this year, we can come back, maybe a special session or even next session, whenever, until the opportunity is no longer available because it's real dollars that Louisiana citizens send to Washington, and we should get the benefit of those dollars when initiatives like this are at work. So,
were you speaking as the chair of the Democratic Party when you made your remarks, or were you speaking as Karen Peterson?
Well, I'm a senator, and I represent the people in District 5. I am who I am, and when I speak, I always speak what I believe and what my convictions are. And so I don't think, I can say when I speak, I know my role as the chair of the Louisiana Democratic Party, and I believe that when I speak, I represent Democratic Party values, and I've gotten support and heard from supporters, both Republicans and Democrats, on the Senate floor that are members that have said, I know what you said, Karen. I heard what you said. You didn't call anybody a racist. You said that race was a factor in the decision-making of some of the members, and I did say that, and I stand by that. But I've never called anyone a racist. People who know me don't even question it. This is an opportunity for, I guess, the Louisiana Republican Party to try to divert attention away from the failed policies that's being offered by them. Look, they got their own problems internally. They can't get agreement. And the failed policies that are being offered by the governor, and to divert attention from some of the things that are going on with this administration. For example, LSU Board of Supervisors, all appointed by Governor Jindal, approving contracts with 50 pages of blank documents. That's ridiculous. It's egregious. You know, when I highlight things like that, that probably makes some people up on the fourth floor uncomfortable. And so they are trying to divert attention and misconstrue, misrepresent what was said. Look at the transcript. I never called anybody a racist. I never will, because that's not who I am. That's not how I was raised. Ken and Gwen Carter would be totally disappointed if they ever heard that. I stand by what I said. It was the truth, and if you want me to come back on, I'd be happy to do that. We can talk about this some more or any other issue that you'd like. I do have to get back to the floor. You have any other quick questions?
Let's go. We've got a bunch of people want to talk to you. Let's take one caller. We'll be very brief. You'll be the only caller for Karen Peterson this morning.
Okay.
Good Quelly in Scotlandville. Hi, Quelly.
Good morning, Senator Peterson. I just want to say that I commend you for taking a stand and having the gall to say what you feel and use the relevant facts to back up what you're saying. My question is, what do you think after the general administration, what do you think will be the future for Louisiana if another Republican is in office, and do you think there are any viable Democratic candidates out there that could run in opposition to the Republican Party?
Well, certainly I think 2015, and thanks for the question, from Scotlandville, I think there's an opportunity in 2015 for the Louisiana Democratic Party to offer Louisiana citizens something different from what they've seen. I believe at that time people will be sickened by the kind of administration that we've had for the previous 4 years, or at that point it'll be 7.5 years, and they will want something different. The devastation being done to higher education, the devastation being done to health care, is something that is going to be very hard to return from. There are professors at universities all across the state looking for opportunities outside the state of Louisiana because they think that this legislature and this governor doesn't care about higher education for our young people. Everybody wants to say, our young people are our future. Well, we need to back that up with policy, okay? And it's not enough to give rhetoric and to go give great speeches all across the country. National ambition should not come before the people of this state that you agreed to serve and you raised your right hand and took an oath. The public welfare and the public safety of people should come first in Louisiana, not New Hampshire, not Virginia, but Louisiana. And so I promise you that as chair of this Louisiana Democratic Party, there will be alternatives to what you've seen in the past, and you're not going to only see that in the gubernatorial candidates that are going to be offered, but it will also be in other statewide positions as well as the state house and the state senate. So I'd ask you to get involved, keep the faith, speak out as I am, don't be afraid, because there are a lot of Louisiana citizens that are tired of the shenanigans, tired of the rhetoric, and they want action and not words, and they don't want people to follow. They want people to be courageous and tell the truth and to move Louisiana forward. And I'd be happy for, you know, to visit with you further. Feel free to call the Louisiana Democratic Party, and I hope more people will get engaged and become vocal.
Thank you, Senator Peterson. Have a great weekend, and appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you, Jim. I appreciate it.
And we'll close this week remembering Joe Willie Namath, January 12, 1969. He led the New York Jets to victory over the Baltimore Colts, Super Bowl III, Miami, Florida, 16-7. The Jets were 18-point underdogs, and Joe Namath is 70 years old today. Happy birthday, Broadway Joe. Until Monday, for Kevin, I'm Jim. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.